If you use a 25% CAGR, then it implies a BTC price of 42 million.
Saudi or the UAE has been stacking Bitcoin in the background and nobody knows about it yet because there wasn't a formal announcement. Is that something that could be on the table for the United States?
I did a call a few weeks ago, 400 financial advisors on the call. We did a poll at the outset. 48% of them had a zero weighting to Bitcoin. Tether reportedly earned $10 billion in net income last year. The entire El Salvador GDP is $30 billion. So it's like, north of 30% of GDP would be Tether's net income. We think that the market cap of BTC can match the market cap of...
Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Matthew Siegel of Van Eck. But Matthew, you've been talking a lot about potential price predictions with Van Eck, looking at the models similar to Michael Saylor's and MicroStrategy. There's been a lot of talk and chatter on Bitcoin Twitter about the potential of power law and all these other models. Now, with everything going on, how much weight do you take into these models? And do you think the models have the potential to be broken to the upside or the downside or snapped in half or whatever?
Hey, Brandon, good to see you. Thanks for having me. I mean, it depends on the model. I think the stock to flow model has been kind of debunked, and I agree with that. You know, the way we look at it is on the short term, the market's driven by liquidity, technicals, risk appetite. Every Bitcoin cycle has gotten progressively smaller. The previous cycle was a 2,000% return from the trough to the peak. So if you haircut that to 1,000 just along the path of each cycle progressively smaller, a 1,000% return would put BTC between 160 and 180 for this cycle, which I guess would conclude this year. It's a very volatile asset. It'll depend on the facts on the ground when we reach that, but that's kind of my roadmap for this cycle is, you know, somewhere 160, 180. Over the medium term, our clients and we are benchmarking Bitcoin to gold, and we think that the market cap of BTC can match the market cap of gold, well, at least the speculative aspects of gold. So about half of gold is used for jewelry or industrial purposes. So if you take aside that part and just consider the store of value market cap of gold, for Bitcoin to reach that would be around a 425K price target. I don't think we're going to reach that this year. I just think it's a bit aggressive to call for a 4x return in 1 year, you know, that we saw in the last couple of months. The long-term holders do come out and sell when the unrealized profits get to be substantial. So I'm thinking maybe next cycle we can reach that 425 to 450K level. And then longer term for BTC to reach into the millions, you have to assume bigger adoption at the government and corporate level. So, and what that means is that central banks would own Bitcoin. Bitcoin would be used as a settlement currency for global trade. So we have a long-term model that goes out to 2050, where we assume that currencies like the yen, the euro, the pound, their decline is kind of baked in the cake. Like the correlation between a currency's value and the relative growth of its GDP is pretty long-standing. And we can see what's happening with euro, yen, pound, GDP. They're all falling. Who's going to pick up that slack? Is it the Chinese RMB, Indian rupee, or perhaps Bitcoin? So in that longer-term model, we assume that between 5 and 10% of global trade begins to be denominated in Bitcoin, and that central banks begin to acquire it at a relatively modest 2% weight. That should bring the velocity of Bitcoin down because those are longer term and stickier holders. And then we use like a velocity of money equation and arrive at a $3 million target. Again, with those assumptions of 2% weight by central banks, 5 to 10% of global trade. And 3 million might sound like a lot, but you know, it's a long-term time horizon, 25 years or so. It essentially implies a 16.16% compound annual growth rate, which is, you know, high, but it's nothing like the 50% that BTC has done over the last decade. So could be upside to that if adoption is even greater.
Yeah, I want to dive into that because it seems like that you're looking at more of, I guess, diminished returns because of how successful Bitcoin's been since its start. Obviously, when more money comes in, things change, but some things like, you know, traditional finance with the ETF starting to come in, I don't even think like that has even started to scratch the surface, even though we're seeing, you know, a historic, you know, ETF launch comparatively to the gold ETFs, but we're also seeing the potential of nation states coming in. You know, do any of these factors let you, I guess, think that there's a potential for this to just blow off the top for the upside and that this model of just, you know, 16% compound annualized returns is almost just conservative at a point?
It could be, you know, I think that'll depend on how the U.S. arranges its fiscal house over the next 10 years. So, you know, it's kind of the early 2030s when the entitlement spending in the U.S. really starts to blow the doors off of our fiscal house. You know, we have two election cycles essentially to try to make a dent in that issue. If it's not addressed and if you know, the rest of the world coalesces around Bitcoin. Maybe it becomes like the dominant monetary asset rather than a reserve asset at relatively small weight, which is what our base case is. We did some math on what returns are required from Bitcoin for a strategic reserve to make a dent in the debt levels. And the assumptions that we made are that U.S. debt growth decelerates a bit. It's been growing at a roughly 7% clip over the last decade. So we assume that Doge, the Elon and Vivek effort to tame the federal bureaucracy, makes some headway, and that debt growth decelerates to 5%. And then we have a matrix. It's going to be up on our website soon where you can plug in your own compound annual growth rate and see what would be the value of that 1 million Bitcoin over the next 20 years. If you use a 25% CAGR, so that's north of our 16% base case, lower than the 50% over the last 10 years. If you use a 25% CAGR, then it implies a BTC price of 42 million. And at that point, BTC would be 18.18% of all the financial assets in the world. 18% is kind of an interesting number because that's the average gold allocation by central banks outside of the US. And there, you know, you'd have a situation where BTC is like a major reserve currency. Could happen. Again, I think it depends on what happens to the U.S., our military, our fiscal situation, the polarization, but it's not our base case.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get that. There, you know, you got to have the base, the bear, and, you know, the bull case. But it definitely seems like there is that potential there to potentially blow off the top. Now, with these different factors, there's been a lot of talk from traditional banks about the new FASB ruling that we just recently had. Obviously, Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy have been the poster child of putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet. But now we have multiple companies in the Magnificent Seven. We've got Amazon, Microsoft, even though they shut it down, and now Meta potentially talking about putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet. How much of a role do you think this is going to play here in 2025? And is VanEck looking at, you know, maybe how Bitcoins are hodling or how companies are hodling Bitcoin on their balance sheet and evaluating those companies a little bit differently if they are?
Yeah, I would caution that the shareholder proposals most recently onto the desk of Meta, those are proposals from relatively small shareholders who are trying to kind of shift the Overton window and force these Mag Sevens to adopt Bitcoin. They're not coming necessarily from the top down. And the Microsoft proposal, I think, only got 0.5% of shareholder approval. So I would caution about getting too optimistic that that's going to happen this year for Mag Seven. That said, the number of companies that have added Bitcoin to their treasury is now above 70. The holdings are up like more than 50% over the last year. It is part of our thesis that corporates are going to increasingly adopt BTC at relatively small weights. And I think we're seeing that pretty much almost every day at this point. Okay, so here's the data. A year ago, corporates collectively, corporates, this is corporates, governments, and ETFs held 1.5 million coins. Now it's 3 million. So the ETFs have been kind of the biggest contributor. But corporates are almost matching that growth, though, over the last year.
Yeah, no. So I mean, I understand the caution when it comes to the Mag 7, but the one unique case I want to talk about is Meta, because Mark Zuckerberg has, significant voting rights when it comes to, what he can do with significant voting rights in the board with Meta, similarly to how Michael Saylor used to have it with MicroStrategy. Now, Mark Zuckerberg has, goats named Maxi and Bitcoin, so take with that what you will. But, do you think that this, like Mark Zuckerberg, because of this voting power and because of just how big Meta is already, that he could potentially be bigger than Michael Saylor when it comes to Bitcoin if he implements that MicroStrategy flywheel that Saylor has coined here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to be the Debbie Downer, but okay, so Meta has $72 billion of cash, so a 1% position, $700 million, right? So maybe 700 million to 2 billion would be like, if they were to do something, that would be my base case on the size. He's not going to do a all in, 100% in Bitcoin. I think that's quite unlikely. But you're right that this is the last of the big tech companies that's still founder led. He controls the majority of the voting shares, and if he really wants to do it, he's going to do it. So I think it's the best shot of the Mag 7. But let's put it this way: another MicroStrategy is not in the price. So there, you can start to talk about your thesis of, some of our price targets being hit this cycle instead of in subsequent cycles.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I hear you on that. So, outside of the Mag 7, all these other companies that you're evaluating, are you looking at like, these Marathon Digital, some of these other companies, maybe a Semler Scientific, some of these companies that are either, involved in the Bitcoin space or have Bitcoin in the balance sheet, are you looking at them and having some sort of multiple? I know JP Morgan came out and had a report that said that they're looking at Bitcoin, like the HODL multiple is what they called it. So the companies that had Bitcoin on the balance sheet at a different multiple than, say, ones that just have a large cash reserve. Is VanEck doing something similar to the way that they're evaluating these companies?
Yeah, we're starting down the path on that. We have a new ETF filing, which will be an active strategy that aims to own firms that are leaders or striving to be leaders in the digital asset space. And I think you'll see over the next year that we're going to become bigger shareholders of some of these companies. From a valuation perspective, I'm hesitant to give too much of a multiple, in addition to what the value of the Bitcoin already is. Now, remember that just adding debt to your balance sheet gives a stock leverage, creates more beta to the upside, more return, but also potentially more risk. I think MicroStrategy has been unique in how directly they've gone after other asset classes, starting with convertible bonds, but now also with plans to move into the preferred share market. MSTR is on a different scale than some of these other firms, and for them, maybe some modest premium. Well, the market's saying it's obviously justified, and I think there's levels to that. You know, at 3x the Bitcoin holdings, you start to wonder, are you ever going to get your money back? At 1.5x, you know, it's a little bit more of a feasible bet. I do like when the listco has some other business that can generate cash. And MicroStrategy, because of their software business, it's not growing, but nor is it evaporating. That'll give some comfort to the debt market that they can at least pay off some of this interest. But when you see like a $10 million market cap company announce that they're pivoting their balance sheet to Bitcoin, and then you look at the income statement and they don't have any revenues, like, many of these are pump and dump scams, and you have to be careful to look at the core business and see if there's any cash flow being generated. To me, that makes the story much more attractive.
Okay, so you're looking at more of, hey, can we finance this debt in order to buy the Bitcoin, so it's an added bonus, opposed to these companies that are just simply announcing Bitcoin on the balance sheet? Because it seems like a lot of them did. They saw an initial huge jump in their stock price, and then some of them fell off the table, it seemed like, initially. But, you know, is that the, I guess you're looking at more of still the traditional way to evaluate a company, and then the Bitcoin is almost an added bonus on the balance sheet? That's right, the Bitcoin Well. They will help you buy Bitcoin and send it directly to your personal wallet. You can sell Bitcoin directly from your personal Bitcoin wallet. And on top of that, if you want to buy large amounts of Bitcoin, they've got some of the most competitive rates in the space, where they've got great white glove service. I'll even help introduce you to my friends over at the Bitcoin Well to make sure that they're taking care of you when you want to go through the over-the-counter service. And on top of that, they help support you and the freedom technology that Bitcoin offers. So I wouldn't partner with a company that I don't use myself. So I use Bitcoin Well to make all of my Bitcoin purchases. So I highly recommend them. So why don't you go to thebitcoinwell.com/greencandle and you can sign up today and join the party at the well. Maybe even get some tokens where you could throw into the wishing well and potentially win some free sats as well. Enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I would say that's true. You know, I mean, we're in business for 70 years by performing, you know, fundamental security analysis. Bias is towards quality companies that can earn above their cost of capital and over a, you know, significant time period. That's how stocks can compound. If you can find one of those that also has a Bitcoin strategy, obviously that would be an amazing story. And then, you know, there's a spectrum. So if a company doesn't have revenues and has been around just because it's selling penny stocks for the last 10 years and suddenly they're adopting Bitcoin, that's not going to be a magic bullet, in my opinion.
Yeah, understood. Now, I want to jump into more of the Bitcoin strategic reserve talk, right? I mean, I think, you know, we all saw President Trump back in July of last year, you know, at the Bitcoin conference, RFK, Senator Lummis, a lot of these greats have already been kind of talking about it and trying to push this forward. Now, do you think it's likely that the United States is going to create a Bitcoin strategic reserve within this next year or via executive order? I know we're recording this just less than a week before Trump comes into office.
It's definitely a topic for the market. So I just posted something on X actually that shows a chart of the betting odds of a strategic reserve being implemented this year alongside the Bitcoin price over the last 4 months. And you can see that they're really moving together. So there does seem to be a bit of a binary approach in the market towards this issue. There's a couple different paths this can go down. We do think that a strategic reserve can be established in name by executive order that involves renaming the Bitcoin that the DOJ already owns and calling it a stockpile. I'd say there's like three different levels. That level can probably be done by executive order with minimal court challenges, minimal lawsuits, right? Because remember that the Democrats are basically any executive order that the Democrats don't like, they're going to sue. And because executive orders have limits, the courts end up being the ultimate arbiter of whether the exec order is constitutional or not. And if it adds to the U.S. debt, the Democrats are going to argue that needs to be authorized by Congress. So in that just simple renaming exercise, I think it gets done. I'm not sure that it's in the first week or the first month. I think there's a lot on his plate, but I think it gets done. There's also the potential to leverage some existing pools of money within the Treasury Department, specifically this fund called the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which currently holds about $50 billion in net assets. And the history of that fund is that the Treasury Secretary has wide latitude to use it to further whatever he perceives to be American interests, the interests of the dollar, the interests of stability of the financial system. This fund back in the 70s was used for some pretty wild stuff. A diplomat went to the Middle East and bought a carpet, charged it to the Exchange Stabilization Fund. I think it was like, hey, we're here like causing, you know, goodwill between state departments. Let's buy a rug and charge it to this fund. That ignited a bit of like media attention, and there has been a push to like not use it as a slush fund. But that is more a cultural change than a legal change. So, you know, Trump's a guy who has bold ideas, and he could try to use that fund to buy more Bitcoin in the open market. I think that would prompt bigger legal challenges. I don't know which way it would shake out. You know, the court's pretty solidly right-leaning these days, but it'd be uncertain. And then you have the legislative approach, Senator Loomis's approach to buy a million in the open market. The odds of that happening are a bit lower. I think there's the political consequences of like enriching a bunch of Bitcoin bros need, you know, significant public relations. I'd prefer to go a different route with this. We can get into like some of the other ideas, but long story short, on a small scale, I think it happens in name. At the biggest scale on the legislative side, I don't think it happens.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I want to go into some of the other ideas because I've seen articles pop up where they're saying Trump doesn't necessarily want to announce it by executive order. Obviously, it's all speculation, and that the U.S. government would buy Bitcoin in the background. Now, I don't know if that's just tinfoil hat here, but is that even possible for the U.S. government to do something? Because there's been rumors that, you know, Saudi or the UAE has been stacking Bitcoin in the background and nobody knows about it yet because there wasn't a formal announcement. Is that something that could be on the table for the United States?
That's a good question. I really don't know. I would imagine that it's probably possible in a small scale to put out some executive order that's like, I've directed the Treasury Secretary to buy, you know, $10 billion of Bitcoin, and we executed the first 20% of it over the last week. Maybe. But I think that this would be disclosed, you know, pretty quickly. The ideas that I, you know, have or would like to, you know, populate and socialize are twofold. One, when we do finally address the unfunded liabilities of the federal government and the, you know, looming bankruptcy of the Social Security model. Many have proposed a more capitalistic approach of basically giving babies a stake in the S&P 500 when they're born. And, you know, they'd all be millionaires by the time they come to age. Bill Ackman has an idea, $7,000 for every kid born in the U.S. Why not? You know, why not make it $7,700 and the $700 in Bitcoin? That would be a way to maybe allay some of the fears of inequality that result when if the U.S. were to buy it directly right now. Another idea is many now realize that if we're going to be dominant in AI, it's going to require significant investment in energy infrastructure. Baseload electricity supply has not really grown in America for the last 15 years. That's going to have to change if we want to be dominant in AI. Trump has floated the idea of what he calls freedom cities, basically auctioning off federal land. The federal government owns more than half the land in Utah, in Nevada, in Idaho. So his idea is auction off this land to those with the most innovative ideas and allow new cities to be born. Maybe they have some characteristics of like special economic zones with favorable tax treatment. Those new cities would require new energy to serve them, new electricity. Maybe Bitcoin miners can be a part of the solution there and get tax breaks for investing in some of these new sources of energy. Or maybe the government could collect a small royalty on some of the early Bitcoin that's mined from those sources of energy. Maybe the Bitcoin could be sold tax-free if it's mined within these certain new cities. And that would be a way of just incentivizing new energy capacity, which I think is necessary if we're going to be dominant in AI and Bitcoin over the next generation.
Now, do you take any weight with, the combination of the growth of the two, or are you looking at AI and Bitcoin a little separate?
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty. But simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's scored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Well, to satisfy the AI demand is going to require tens of billion dollars worth of data center investment and capacity. That money's not available right away. So when you look at who has existing capacity that could potentially be repurposed to meet the demand from the new AI industry, Bitcoin miners stand out with like 15 gigawatts of supply. I just think of them as synergistic.
Okay, yeah. And I mean, I could definitely see that, like AI data centers, some have Bitcoin miners in them in order to help mitigate some of that cost, and it'll kind of start this trickle down effect. But I want to get back into the potential of a Bitcoin strategic reserve. Obviously, we hit on the United States, but there's been 25 other countries, maybe even more, that have come out and said something along the lines of either a presidential candidate or a new prime minister who's very bullish on Bitcoin. There's been a lot of speculations of other countries potentially developing a Bitcoin strategic reserve. Now, do you think that this would almost light a fire in the United States to hurry up and get one? Or is the U.S. going to essentially go at their own pace and, you know, kind of try to determine the Bitcoin strategic reserve when they see it best fit for them?
I don't think it's not clear right now which is going to go first. And the countries that are proposing this are all democracies. So I'll just list them out, those that are kind of suggesting the possibility. There's a presidential candidate in Poland who's proposed a national Bitcoin reserve. There's a parliament lawmaker in Japan who is asking for a formal analysis on this topic. In France, there's a legislator who has declared support for strategic reserve. None of these have reached the point where we're close to a vote in any way, nor are we close to a vote in the US. I think the idea is just to open the discussion, let the debate occur. The more that a big country signals it's likely, the more likelihood there is that another big country will jump on board. I don't have huge conviction in who will be the first tipping point. It seems like if Trump is into it, then by executive order, you know, we're likely to be first, and that should accelerate what's happening in other countries.
Okay, yeah, that definitely makes sense. And yeah, if Trump wants to get on it and, you know, really be the first four at the forefront of all of this, obviously a lot of people would follow suit of the United States. But I heard a recent interview with you with Natalie Brunel. You talked about the potential of banks getting into Bitcoin and potentially being custodians. Now, we've hit on, you know, the potential of the ETFs. We've hit on corporations, and we've hit on countries, but I haven't really heard too many people talk about banks potentially becoming custodians of Bitcoin, maybe issuing Bitcoin to their clients. Now, the last administration was very bearish and shut this down, but do you think that there's a possibility with this new administration coming in that that is a possibility in this next 4-year cycles where you can go to, you know, Capital One, JP Morgan Chase, and some of these other bigger banks and potentially just hit the buy Bitcoin button in your bank account?
Yeah, it's kind of ironic to think about because Bitcoin is literally the anti-bank. But when you think about who do Americans trust to store their most valuable assets, it's definitely banks, right? Safe deposit boxes still exist. In fact, when the Winklevoss twins were first setting up Gemini, they split up their private keys and drove around the Midwest and basically deposited them at a number of like smaller banks for safekeeping. You know, I don't think banks are going to make large allocations to Bitcoin, although the largest bank in Italy this week actually just bought mm-hmm. Bitcoin for their prop account, calling it an experiment. But in terms of custodying it on behalf of clients, I think that'll probably happen in the next couple of years. And there have been a number of, as you noted, the Biden administration, they put out this executive order early in the administration instructing all the federal agencies to crack down on crypto. And the way that that was implemented for the banks was through an accounting rule, SAB 121, that made it very punitive to hold even client Bitcoin. You'd have to record it as a corresponding asset and liability on your balance sheet. That makes it very capital intensive and uneconomic to custody Bitcoin. And the other kind of headwind to adoption by banks was the FDIC, which has come out recently in letters that Coinbase obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests that showed the FDIC instructing banks explicitly to slow down or close their digital asset business lines, you know, making it hard for banks even to just provide transactional banking services to crypto intermediaries. Both of those are going to end. I think you will have some of the smaller and more innovative banks re-enter the market first, just by giving transactional banking services to crypto exchanges, market makers, venture capital funds, all of the types who were debanked in the last cycle. And some small number will probably allow clients to buy and custody Bitcoin directly. It's not going to be the mega banks, because those guys just have too much at risk from the politics of it. If, you know, when the political winds shift and eventually the Democrats win an election, you know, they have to kind of hedge how aggressive they've gotten. So, yeah, I think it's going to happen, but it's not where the leading edge will be of adoption.
That's interesting. Now, because, you know, we've had obviously Jamie Dimon publicly just very anti-Bitcoin in the media, but JP Morgan releasing reports that you should have at least 1% of your portfolio towards Bitcoin. And a lot of these bigger banks are doing something similar, whether it's 1-5% of your portfolio, they're recommending you have that towards Bitcoin. Now, why wouldn't they offer? Why do you think that would be something that would be, I guess, too polarizing for them to embrace if they're already releasing reports like this?
It's just the difference, I think, between serving institutional clients and serving retail clients. So you're right, JP Morgan's a market maker on some of these Bitcoin ETFs. JP Morgan Securities covers and banks the Bitcoin miners. They do, you know, good research in the space. But to offer this to the retail deposit franchise is, I just think it's a big innovator's dilemma. It's not their core business. They're not going to make the type of money they make off of taking your fiat and rehypothecating it. There's very little incentive for the bank boards to do this. The risk reward of getting aggressive in the space is not attractive.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting. So why do you think like more banks are starting to, I guess, you know, buy Bitcoin, get slowly incentivized? I mean, we just talked a little bit briefly about the biggest bank in Italy now buying Bitcoin, although it was a very small amount. I believe it was, $1 million worth or 11 Bitcoin total. So it wasn't anything significant, at least for a large institution like that. But, you know, why do you think banks are starting to shift over there? Is it because of client demand, or is it because they're just seeing the writing on the wall and they don't want to potentially lose some of this power and clients? I think it's interesting that we're seeing banks, you know, as you stated, you know, Bitcoin's kind of the anti-bank, and now banks are starting to come around. So how do you see banks, I guess, kind of intertwining in a potentially more Bitcoinized world?
Yeah. So from the Great Depression until the Clinton administration, it was illegal for commercial banks to also conduct investment banking business lines. And during the Clinton administration, there was deregulation and many of the banks entered investment banking. And you could argue, you know, that what maybe like helped accelerate the financial crisis in 2008, but nevertheless, that deregulation persists and all of the largest banks have large capital markets, investment banking, M&A advisory, prop trading, although they kind of renamed it something else nowadays. It's those parts of the businesses that are interested in Bitcoin and digital assets, partially because of the volatility. Anything that's very volatile like that, you know, you can make money from. It's not the core, you know, retail deposit taking banking franchises that are interested in Bitcoin for the reasons that we just discussed. Some lawmakers, you know, like Elizabeth Warren, if she had her way, Glass-Steagall would be reinstituted and there would be, you know, the separation of powers. And it, in that world, you know, adoption might be slower. But as long as these institutions are connected, parts of them are going to be looking to bring new products to market and advise growing companies that are looking to IPO. You can be sure JP Morgan, you know, wanted a piece of the Coinbase IPO. If Circle comes public, they're going to want a piece of that. So they need the intellectual human resources to be active in any new growth area.
Okay, yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I think that, yeah, the intertwining of the two, the investment bank and just the banks in general, is kind of unique. But, you know, Van Eck has come out with, you know, one of these reports where, you know, similar to the ones I've named from other banks, about having a certain percentage of your portfolio allocated towards Bitcoin, whether that's ETF or cold storage or maybe a combination of the two. Now, do you think that that percentage, obviously, as Bitcoin continues to rise, that, you know, we're going to see, because Bitcoin just continually outperforms, you know, something like bonds or maybe even the S&P 500, that, you know, that 60-40 portfolio that has been so coveted for so long is essentially going to die out, and it's going to be, you know, maybe a percentage of stocks and a percentage of Bitcoin, and that's going to be the new standard of portfolios here going forward? I'm taking a quick break from this podcast to tell you guys about Unbank. Unbank is a Bitcoin exchange with a network of ATMs all over the United States in trusted places like Costco. So you could buy and sell Bitcoin while you're getting a double chunk chocolate cookie. So on top of that, there's zero fees when you sell. That's right. I didn't stutter, folks. Zero fees. So you can visit over 28,000 locations all scattered across the US. They've been a trusted partner since 2014. And to start off this year hot, I've partnered with them to bring you a chance to win $200. That's right, two cold smackers, two Ben Franks, two pieces of cheddar. All you have to do is download the app at unbank.com/greencandle, and you'll be entered in a chance to win in the raffle that'll take place on February 28th. So enter now, enter quickly, enter often, and I'll see you guys all on February 28th for the chance for you to win $200. All right, enough for me, back to the show.
I mean, that's certainly our bet. Maybe not that bonds go to zero, but that Bitcoin starts to creep into these 60-40 portfolios. You know, if there's the disappointment for the ETFs last year was that the wirehouses, the big banks and brokers, did not really get aggressive in pushing their advisors to populate clients' portfolios with Bitcoin. That's created an opening from our perspective. Like, those are typically our largest distributors and customers. And the fact that they've been slow to adopt means that we've actually had an opportunity. And there's a part of our business where we sell these model portfolios directly to allocators, our version of the 60-40. It often includes a lot of VanEck ETFs because we make these building blocks that you can use to make your own version of a 60-40 or whatever you want. That's one of the fastest growing parts of our business. We've added a number of people in the last couple months who are going to accelerate that even further. And we think we have a good opportunity to take market share from these like slow moving 60-40 advisors. So like on our website under the model portfolio tab, you'll see a bunch of options that generally include like 1-5% Bitcoin. When you do the analysis on what type of volatility it adds, what that means for the drawdown of your portfolio when there's inevitably a correction in stocks, how much is Bitcoin going to make that drawdown even worse? Up to 5% or so, you don't even really realize it. The impact on the drawdown has been relatively modest, and on volatility as well, relatively modest. Meanwhile, the performance boost has been material. Above about 6%, you start to notice that volatility and drawdown even more. The performance of this asset class is such, like anytime you bootstrap 0 to 3 trillion over a decade or so, it's going to look good at 100%, right? If you can stomach the volatility. But it's kind of that 1-6% is the sweet spot, with the majority of that being just in straight Bitcoin combination of cold storage and ETFs.
Yeah, and I definitely see like that's going to be kind of the future. But it's interesting that you said that institutions haven't really pushed that to their advisors. Why do you think that that is? Is it just a cautionary tale? Is it the lack of education around it? You know, is it maybe the resistance from a lot of these people who have traditional financial advisors where, you know, they don't know much about Bitcoin? Why do you think that there's been that, I guess, resistance there?
I think it's politics and the innovator's dilemma. So, you know, on the politics front, the banks were told, but you know, by the FDIC, by the SEC, like, don't get into this business. So if you're on the board of one of these, like, just the risk reward of being out front, publicly bullish, pushing clients into it, just not very attractive, not really going to move the needle relative to your core business, but it's going to generate a lot of ink, a lot of questions. Your CEO is going to end up being asked it at the top of every interview, and there may be other, you know, strategic priorities that are bigger than Bitcoin. So I think that's the main thing.
Okay. So outside of, you know, that, do you think that there's going to be, I guess, you know, more adoption as we're seeing it come through just because of the price action? And, you know, do you think that 100K mark, the 0.1 million price point of Bitcoin, surpassing that within this past month or so, has been significant enough to, I guess, maybe break through that mental barrier, whether it's, you know, more positive media coverage of Bitcoin? Do you see that shift changing sometime this year or in the next 2 years?
Yeah, that shift happened immediately after Election Day. My calendar started to fill up with a lot more meetings from consultants, allocators, and advisors who were holding off on BTC basically for political reasons. And now they're getting the green light. The price action validated the change in politics and fundamentals, and people are open to it in a way that they were not in 22 and 23. And there's still so much more to go. I did a call a few weeks ago, 400 financial advisors on the call. We did a poll at the outset. 48% of them had a zero weighting to Bitcoin. And when we asked what would make you allocate, I think I gave like four choices: higher prices, lower prices, I guess there's three choices: higher prices, lower prices, or nothing would make me allocate. Like, I'm a no coiner, right? The no coiner percentage was pretty low, right? Most of them were looking for lower prices to add. So it definitely feels like there has been a shift from the advisor community. Now, they still don't have that 30,000 foot air cover from the CIO at Morgan Stanley, you know, saying, okay, put 2% in, everybody, this is your weight. So that's where we're trying to bring these models to market and capitalize on the interest and try to steal some of those customers away. I'm still optimistic that some of these big brokers will have the guts to put out an official Bitcoin weighting, but it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And it seems like, yeah, with the shift in the recent election, that Trump is going to play a significant role. Now, obviously, Satoshi created Bitcoin and everything along those lines. But is Trump potentially going to be the most influential person in the Bitcoin space just because of his friendly policies and everything that he brings forward, the amount of money that can now have access towards Bitcoin, and just, you know, maybe a little bit of that regulatory clarity? Could he potentially be the most influential character in the Bitcoin space, at least for the time being?
Yeah. President of the U.S. is always the most powerful person in the world if they have a strong opinion on a topic. So this is the first president who has a strong opinion. Thank God it's bullish. So it's definitely part of our optimistic thesis for this year.
Okay, so on the flip side of things, would it say we don't get the executive order or the executive order for the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve, all these other things? Do you think that everything is still going to be trending in the right direction? Do you think that even if Trump doesn't do anything, I guess, super positive, he just does everything, you know, more on the lukewarm side of things, that would be, I guess, sounding off the alarm bells for the potential of a negative party coming in? Or do you think that that scenario is just, I guess, very unlikely due to what we've seen previously with his, you know, talks and everything surrounding Bitcoin and the space?
Thankfully, there are five states that now have a legislation to establish some form of a Bitcoin strategic reserve. Yesterday, Texas and Oklahoma on the same day, legislation put forward. I think the Texas one is really interesting because it doesn't involve putting taxpayer money at risk. It rather has the state of Texas or gives the citizens the option to pay taxes and other state fees and fines in Bitcoin, and then legislates that the Bitcoin would not be sold for 5 years. And I think that the positive vibes from Trump and from the White House are making it much more politically feasible to get these bills in front of Congress at the state level. And with five now on the table, our call is that at least one of them will pass. And that just means that, you know, Bitcoin's now a topic politically, and it's, even if Trump can't execute on some of his campaign promises, look at J.D. Vance, right? He owns a lot of Bitcoin. If you look at the questions that he asked Fed Chair Powell last year, J.D. Vance is deeply concerned about fiscal dominance, about the hollowing out of U.S. manufacturing capacity, about the Fed just having too much power and not executing monetary policy according to a predetermined plan, but rather in a way that kind of helps those who are closest to the money spigot and hurts a lot of his core constituents. So, you know, Trump is in his 80s. Vance is a lot younger. You can see where the math is going on this. Every year, there's no coiners who die off and new Bitcoiners are born. And yeah, maybe we have like less upside and more downside this year if a reserve doesn't happen. But I'm guessing that's probably a buying opportunity if we get a big drawdown.
Yeah, and that's good to hear that, no matter what seems to happen, it seems like you are very bullish with everything going forward. But, you know, how much weight do you take with these states potentially getting in for a Bitcoin strategic reserve? Because it seems like almost every single one is going to propose one at this point in time. It just seems like it's the new wave. Now, how big of a difference would it be from, you know, states, maybe even some of the bigger states like Florida or Texas, you know, embracing Bitcoin comparatively to the U.S. having a strategic reserve? Like, what are the core differences there? And just from like a political standpoint, one of the most crooked industries, most fiat industries there is the health insurance industry. Let's be honest, you don't even need health insurance. If you could find somebody that would help you find awesome doctors, negotiate your bills, and fund those bills through a peer-to-peer funding platform, would you take it? That sounds pretty appealing to me, and that's why I've joined forces with CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is a place that you can do that all in one. One giant place, you can have a group of peers where they will help you find the best healthcare that you need. On top of all that, I can help get you a discount to get you on your feet and get everything started. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE for 3 months at $99. And with all of this, you will get the healthcare you need. You don't have to worry about going through to the doctor, negotiating, everything like that. Did you hit your deductible? Did you not? Is this insurance company going to cover this claim? Is it not? You don't have to worry about any of that stress. And you can just get CrowdHealth behind you where they can help you get the number one place to have a health insurance alternative. So join the revolution. Go to joincrowdhealth.com. Tell them that Green Candle sent you. And join me and the rest of the great CrowdHealth users in this peer-to-peer funding platform. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, the range of estimates on what a Federal Reserve would look like Bitcoin Policy Institute, their proposal equates to like $20 billion of buying. The Loomis plan, you know, could be closer to 70 to 100 billion dollars of buying. No state can approach that level. So in terms of pure kind of market impact, any single state is going to pale in comparison to the federal government. But in terms of signaling and laying the groundwork for the next cycle, I think they're all, you know, quite meaningful.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's definitely, it seems like, levels to it, right? So, I mean, I think that it's going to be a very interesting year in 2025 to see how it essentially plays out just on the state and the other country levels. You know, you and I actually met in adopting Bitcoin in El Salvador, where now they're increasing their Bitcoin buy. And, you know, there used to be one Bitcoin a day. Now we've seen a few days where Bukele has purchased 11 Bitcoin. I believe when we spoke, you said you were very bullish on everything going on in El Salvador. Do you think everything, other countries are starting to pay attention on the positives that Bukele has, you know, been able to bring? And, you know, as Max and Stacy love to say, the great rebranding of El Salvador, essentially making it more of a destination. Do you think that they've had a significant impact, like whether it's Bukele or El Salvador, just in general, as to other countries looking at this? Or is it just, you know, because El Salvador is a smaller country, not as big of an impact as maybe we all believe in the Bitcoin space?
I think it's had a huge impact. You know, part of it is, yes, Bitcoin is legal tender, mining Bitcoin at the government level. But I think it also, like, Bukele's re-election kind of kicked off this global wave of right-wing candidates winning, right? Free market candidates winning, the new green scam, you know, losing legitimacy. All these banks have pulled out of their net zero alliances. Milei in Argentina, you know, winning that election. I think the world's coming to its senses, frankly, on that we kind of went too far away from free market fare. And what, you know, Bukele and Milei are kind of the tip of the spear for Latin America swinging back in the favor of free markets. You can see that capital is attracted to where it is treated best, right? Tether this week, in fact, announced that they are relocating from, I guess it's the British Virgin Islands, to El Salvador. Tether reportedly earned $10 billion in net income last year. The entire El Salvador GDP is $30 billion. So it's like, you know, north of 30% of GDP would be Tether's net income. Are they going to pay taxes? That's a question. El Salvador passed a law last year that gives tax exemptions to tech companies that invest in the country. So I think, you know, more companies will look to re-domicile in El Salvador now that it is safer and more pro-growth. So we run at VanEck some emerging market debt strategies. So we're picking bonds in various emerging market countries, and we're using most definitely a policy lens when evaluating these countries. Who's running a responsible monetary policy? Who's running a responsible fiscal policy and is most likely to be able to pay off their debt? And we've made, you know, pretty sizable bets in both Argentina and El Salvador. Thankfully, you know, those bets are playing out. The bonds still look cheap to us, more responsible on the spending front. Meanwhile, GDP has accelerated thanks to the tourism inflow. And tourism, you know, I said capital goes where it's treated best. You know, same with tourism. Tourists are kind of the faster reaction function, but I think they're the leading indicator that corporates are going to be setting up shop in El Salvador as well.
Yeah, and I definitely think that the money is going to follow the incentives. And, you know, if El Salvador becomes very incentive-based, which they obviously have, we're going to see people follow suit like Tether. I believe Strike did the same thing maybe about a year ago as well when this was passed. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, more corporations start to follow that trend and, you know, just kind of, yeah, see where everything goes here in this next calendar year for 2025. But you've been very generous with your time. So why don't you tell people where they can find out more about VanEck and potentially some of the products that you guys offer?
Sure. Yeah, we have more than 20 different products across digital assets. Many of them are kind of Bitcoin specific with the ETFs in US, Europe, Australia. We're going to be more active in the Bitcoin mining space this year. We have some new products that are going to be investing actively across that ecosystem. So to get our research, please check out VanEck_US on X, or myself, Matthew_Siegel, also on X. And we put out all of our research there.
Awesome stuff. Yeah. And I'll put all that in the show notes, and you should definitely check it out because they put out great things on X and on VanEck and all their great products. So Matthew, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.